Welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, Supreme Arguments Over Marriage. We break format for a live hour-long call-in on the marriage cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Kate Kendall, Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, is just back from Washington, D.C., where she witnessed the Defense of Marriage Act and Proposition 8 Supreme Court arguments in person. She'll fill us in on the proceedings with her insights and firsthand perspective. Internationally known same-sex relationship lawyer and author Frederick Hertz is also with us, giving us practical advice on what the potential rulings could mean in our lives. We'll take your calls live on the air. This is a great opportunity to ask questions of two savvy experts and hear an eyewitness account of these historic Supreme Court proceedings. So stick around. I'll give the phone number now, so get ready to jot it down. We'll probably start taking your calls in 10 or 15 minutes. The number here in the 415 area code is 415-841-4134. That's 841-4134. There's also a toll-free number if you're out of state, 866-798-TALK. Now, a little bit more about our experts tonight. Kate Kendall leads the National Center for Lesbian Rights, a national legal organization committed to advancing the civil and human rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and their families through litigation, public policy advocacy, and public education. She joined NCLR as legal director in 1994. Wow, almost 19 years ago.
That's a long time.
And was named executive director 2 years later. And we met almost that long ago.
I know. We've known each other a long time, Eric.
Yeah, so under her leadership, NCLR's programs, budget, and impact have grown exponentially. And the issues facing the LGBT community, from homophobia and sports to immigration policy, have taken center stage in our nation's discussion of civil rights and justice. Kate is a nationally recognized spokesperson for LGBT rights and has an active voice in major media, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Advocate, NPR, CNN. She's been on Out in the Bay several times before. I'm glad to have her back tonight. Kate Kendall, welcome, and thanks for coming
in. Really happy to be here, Eric. Thanks.
Frederick Hertz is an attorney in Oakland, California, who provides legal counsel to same-sex partners on the formation and dissolution of their relationships. He also serves as a mediator and arbitrator in same-sex dissolutions, especially in matters involving real estate disputes. He has written or co-authored several books, including Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions, published by NOLA Press. You can find out more about him on his website, samesexlaw.com. He's been our guest many times before as well. Frederick Hertz, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Happy to be here.
So, Kate Kendall, let me start with you. What's it like to be inside the U.S. Supreme Court to see and hear these historic proceedings?
Well, I just feel elated, and felt elated all week to be there. I've never been in the Supreme Court for an argument before. I attempted to attend the Romer versus Evans argument back in, gosh, this would be 1995. It was October 1995. And got there at 5:30 in the morning, and I had to be in the public line because I wasn't yet a member. I hadn't joined the Supreme Court bar, and I never did get a seat. And so I joined the bar because I thought, if I ever want to go again, the attorney line's a little bit shorter. That's the way they work things. That's one of the perks. And didn't leave anything to chance, and it was really something to be there this week. At a time when so much forward movement is happening for LGBT people in this country, beginning really back to the election is where you can trace it, and obviously even before then the seeds were being planted, and to just be a witness to your own liberation as it is happening, and to see the court really engaged in questions about the reality of our lives and who LGBT people are in this culture, I'll never forget it. It was really the experience of a lifetime.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to hear more about it. So to set things up, we're going to play a little bit of NPR's coverage of the proceedings. It includes audio from the Supreme Court sessions. And after we finish playing this, I'll ask both of you to add some detail. We'll start with the Proposition 8 arguments. This is a section from NPR reporter Carrie Johnson's report. We'll pick it up where... Uh-oh, I was supposed to ask you this before we got on the air. What's the first name of Cooper? Proposition
Charles
8
Cooper.
Attorney Charles Cooper, thank
Charles
you,
Cooper.
And Justice Kagan are going back and forth over whether marriage is primarily for procreation.
Your Honor, even with respect to couples over the age of 55, it is very rare that both parties to the couple are infertile. And the traditional...
if a couple... I can just assure you, if both the woman and the man are over the age of 55, there are not a lot of children coming out of that marriage.
Ted Olson, the lawyer for two same-sex couples in California who challenged the ban, said marriage is a fundamental right.
The case that's before you today is whether or not California can take a class of individuals based upon their characteristics, their distinguishing characteristics, remove from them the right of privacy, liberty, association, spirituality, and identity that marriage gives them.
Several justices said they were struggling with the case. If they threw out the California same-sex marriage ban, wouldn't they be forced to extend the right to marry to people in states that don't even recognize domestic partnerships? Others seem to find the idea of a right to marry rather novel, maybe too novel for the Supreme Court to weigh in. Justice Samuel Alito.
But you want us to step in and render a decision based on an assessment of the effects of this institution, which is newer than cell phones or the internet?
Justice Kennedy, who puzzled through his options over the course of the argument, had this to say to the lawyer representing two same-sex couples.
The problem with the case is that you're really asking for us to go into uncharted waters, and you can play with that metaphor. There's a wonderful destination, or there's a cliff, whatever the metaphor is.
Outside the courthouse, reporters caught up with Olson, the lawyer fighting the marriage ban, and asked for his prediction.
Based upon the questions that the justices asked, I have no idea.
Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
And as you see there, it's anyone's guess. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are Kate Kendall of the National Center for Lesbian Rights and attorney Frederick Hertz. Kate was in Washington, D.C. watching the hearings. We just heard this little telescope version. What do you get from, what are some of the key nuances or surprises that we didn't hear in that?
Well, you know, if you
report?
Just listen to that clip, it sounds pretty dismal. It sounds like, oh, my gosh, the court is not going to vote in any way in favor of the rights of LGBT same-sex couples. But that's not true. The court clearly, and we knew this going in, is reticent to invalidate all the laws in states that do not recognize marriage between same-sex couples. There was no doubt going in, some of the attorneys, maybe Ted Olson and David Boies, wanted to put a more positive gloss on it. But I think none of us believed that it was possible that the court was going to end up with a 50-state solution saying that every state had to recognize the marriage rights for same-sex couples. But what did come out of that Prop 8 argument and discussion is that there are a number of justices that do think that Prop 8 does burden couples in California. Justice Kennedy at one point talked about the 40,000 children being raised by children. The 40,000 children being raised by same-sex couples, and that those couples and those children are disadvantaged by not having their parents' relationship recognized.
Right. Like, so the kids have a standing in this case in a way.
And he said, who's going to speak for the children? The children have a voice. Someone needs to be here to hear the voice of the children. And so I do think that what's going to happen with Prop 8 is we're going to see it struck down on a technicality. It's going to be either the standing of the proponents will be found to be not sufficient. Or there will be, maybe the court will decide, look, we shouldn't have ever taken this case in the first place, and one of the lower court rulings will be the law of the case, and Prop 8 will be DOA in June.
Mm-hmm.
But it is what the thing that I took away from the argument in the Prop 8 case was that the court understands that they are either, the question they're facing is to either join where history is headed or to reject where history is headed. And, you hear that quote from Alito. One thing that I do wish could have been a stronger
Alito
point.
Alito quote, meaning about the
when,
internet.
When Alito said, this thing is newer than the internet. Well,
right.
Guess
right.
What? Marriage is not newer than the internet. And I feel like there were a couple of moments where, as a lawyer, you have to kind of sit on your hands. I wanted to jump up and say, I have a response to that.
Baker versus Nelson.
But I couldn't do that. But, you want to say, look, the right to marry is a fundamental right for all couples in this country. We're not talking about the right of same-sex couples as some different kind of marriage. What we're talking about is for far too long, we have excluded loving, committed couples from the same right that everyone else enjoys. It's that fundamental right that we want extended to same-sex couples rather than the creation of a new right. And I feel like that point wasn't made quite as strongly, although I do think we're looking at least four justices and maybe Kennedy, who do have this sense that yes, they understand that excluding same-sex couples from this fundamental right does have some constitutional problems with it. Kennedy's not quite ready to say the whole country needs to embrace the fundamental right for all couples. But I think he's only a few years off, and I think we already have several justices on the court that are with us, but the posture of these cases, both of them, give them the ability to rule in a much more narrow way than the broad ruling that Ted Olson and David Boies were seeking.
So, Fred, would you, are you as optimistic as Kate is?
I am, but actually in a different respect. So, first of all, I think there's two aspects of what happened that I want to add to what Kate said, which I agree with everything she said. I want to add two things. One is that it was interesting to me that no one seemed to be bothered by the issue of whether the voters should have the last say. We've had a lot of political discussion in the last 5 years, and the California Supreme Court was totally preoccupied about this issue of the initiative. And what I found so actually comforting is that even the justices who might not be on my side actually accepted the premise that this is a civil rights issue, that this is not something where we just kind of throw the gay people to the voters and see how they do. Mm-hmm. The second thing, and I say this as somebody who knew Jack Baker, I was a high school student, he was the college student body president in Minnesota in 1970, and he dared to try to marry his partner. And that case was thrown out by the Supreme Court as not even deserving attention. It was considered laughable. And we forget that, for example, in Bowers versus Hardwick, the decision was premised on the Bible saying that homosexuality was immoral. So in my mind, the sincerity...
Let listeners know what Bowers versus Hardwick is.
This was the first sodomy case where the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the laws criminalizing sodomy, later overturned by Lawrence v. Texas. The dignity, the respect, I mean, to hear even justices like Alito or Roberts talking about gay couples in a committed, loving relationship, I thought, you know, I can go home now.
Even if they're going to vote against it, at least they're recognizing it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, first of all, you say recognize. I'm not sure. I mean, let's talk about how much our community has changed. You know, if you looked around in 1970... and you looked around for long-term, committed, loving couples raising children that they had brought into the world,
right,
it wasn't a big crowd 40 years ago.
Right.
So what I would say is that as a reflection on how our community has changed,
yep,
I'm glad that the justices see it and are able to talk openly about it, but it felt like such a victory to see the kind of intellectual debate and civil rights debate in the context of a real lack of moral condemnation, a lack of trivialization.
So true. No, it's so true. I was just thinking about this today as I was sort of reflecting on being there. The Bowers claim, the claim that Michael Bowers brought, saying, I have the private, in my own home, I should not have same-sex sexual intimacy criminalized. And Byron Walker, who wrote the majority opinion in Bowers versus Hardwick, called that claim facetious.
Mm.
It was ridiculous to even think that we had the right in the privacy of our own home to be free from governmental intrusion.
25 years ago.
And that, yes, that was the blink of an eye ago in terms of civil rights time.
Right, right.
The tone of respect and civility. I even, you know, we didn't even hear from Scalia some of the things he's said in speeches to law students where he said, well, look, if you can make it a crime for somebody not to murder, then why can't you condemn homosexuality? And I was thinking he might let some of that slip. And he didn't. And I think it really did feel like the majority of the court saw our community through a lens of common humanity. And I don't think that's ever happened before.
Agreed.
Wow. Yeah, okay. And I hear that even Rush Limbaugh today said that gay marriage is inevitable.
Well, then you know the apocalypse is coming.
Okay, so before we get into lots of detail on Proposition 8, we're going to hear some of the DOMA hearing, Defense of Marriage Act hearing proceedings, and then we'll take listener calls. So I want to remind you of the phone number. This is a great chance to ask experts and an eyewitness about these historic proceedings. The call-in number, again, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you'd rather send us an email, you can send it to Eric with a C at outinthebay.com. That's Eric at outinthebay.com. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page out in the Bay. We've got some friends here standing by, eager to answer your phone calls or take your emails or your Facebook messages. Judith, Dave, and Cecily, thank you so much for being here. So let's go. Yesterday, the High Court heard arguments on the Defense of Marriage Act. Again, here's a couple minutes of NPR's coverage by Kerry Johnson. The Obama administration is not defending the law in court. We pick it up where Paul Clement, the attorney for House Republicans, is advocating for DOMA.
The House's single most important prerogative, which is to pass legislation and to have that legislation, if it's going to be repealed, only be repealed through a process where the House gets to fully participate.
But when he got to the substance of his argument, Clement ran into some trouble. Justice Anthony Kennedy, a likely swing voter in this week's gay rights cases, suggested the federal government was trampling on the states.
You are at real risk of running in conflict with what has always been thought to be the essence of the state police power, which is to regulate marriage, divorce, custody.
Then Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg chimed in. She said the current system turns same-sex couples into second-class citizens.
You're saying, no, state, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
Clement said Congress simply wanted to make sure couples are treated equally across state lines. But none of the justices seemed satisfied with that. Moments later, they turned their fire on Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer arguing to invalidate DOMA. Chief Justice Roberts said he doubted same-sex couples needed any extra protection from the courts.
You don't doubt that the lobby supporting the enactment of same-sex marriage laws in different states is politically powerful, do you?
With respect to that category, that categorization of the term for purposes of heightened scrutiny, I would, Your Honor. I don't.
Really?
Yes.
As far as I can tell, political figures are falling over themselves to endorse your side of the case.
Roberts seemed to suggest the fast-changing political climate outside the courtroom was going to matter more than anything the justices decide. The key figure in today's case is 83-year-old Edith Windsor. Windsor married her spouse, Thea Spire, in Canada in 2007. Their union was recognized by the state of New York, where they lived together for four decades. But after Spire died, Windsor got a rude awakening from the IRS, a tax bill for more than $360,000. One she would have avoided, Windsor said, if her spouse was a man.
In the midst of my grief, I realized that the federal government was treating us as strangers, and I paid a humongous estate tax.
Windsor said even after so many years together, getting married was more than just legally different. She said it was magic. The courts expected.
That was Kerry Johnson of NPR. With her coverage of the Defense of Your Marriage Act arguments yesterday, I'm here with Fred Hertz and Kate Kendall. What are you? What are we hearing here? What are the most important things in that little bit we heard? And then what are we missing? What are some of the surprises that perhaps you heard in the courtroom, Kate?
Well, you know, what was interesting is when the court walked in for the Prop 8 argument, you know, we're all there waiting for quite some time. They want to get everybody in, and then the justices come in. When they came in for the Prop 8 hearing, everyone was grim-faced. They looked like they were headed to a firing squad. And it was a little bit of a worrisome sign. Well, when they walked in to the DOMA hearing, everyone was all smiles. And what I took from that is I think the court is much more fractured around Prop 8 and what to do, and maybe a real division about whether they should have taken the case at all, than they were around DOMA. I think there is a clear majority that for the federal government to pick and choose winners and losers among married couples based solely on sexual orientation, and to treat couple A, to lavish them with federal benefits, and as they've always recognized marriages for in any state, and then to exclude only same-sex couples from federal recognition, really just does not pass any sort of the most basic constitutional scrutiny. And it definitely seemed that there was a majority of the court in that direction. Now, we also have a standing issue in the DOMA case.
Right. I mean, it's almost the same from all the coverage I heard, both on NPR and on the major, the commercial networks, ABC and CBS. It seemed to be that you know, Kennedy was not ready to go there, but he was perfectly willing to say, you know, why do you have standing here?
Well, the thing about it with DOMA, though, is that the only way to rule on the merits of DOMA and to strike it down altogether is to find standing. And there's two kinds of standing that the court is dealing with in DOMA. And I'll go through standing quickly, because who would have thought we'd have the two of the key cases. Both cases have this standing issue. You have the congressional committee set up by the House, the leadership of the House. They're defending DOMA when the Obama administration withdrew from defending DOMA. And then you have the U.S. government itself that is, essentially stepping in and defending, but not the Department of Justice is not defending. And so what I think is going to happen in the case is that they're going to find that the congressional committee does not have standing, but the government does have standing, and that then they're going to get to the merits on DOMA, and I think we're going to have five votes to see DOMA struck down.
All right,
what I think I wanted to just expand on something that Kate is saying is that one of the things that was the most surprising, I think important, is that two of the fundamental conservative positions that even the quote liberals on the Supreme Court feel is a hostility to federal intervention in state law and a desire to restrict who gets to come to court. These are two policies that have mostly been used by the conservatives to harm gun control efforts, to harm environmental efforts, and ironically, in both instances, they're playing out in this situation, and ironically, the supporters of gay rights are inviting federal constitutional intervention in California,
right,
which I'm strongly in favor of. And I think one of the actual reasons for the discomfort in this Prop 8 case is not an issue of gay rights at all. It's an issue of states' rights. And that to ask the federal government to intervene, especially keep in mind where the California Supreme Court had no problem with upholding Prop 8, I think there is a real tension here about these issues of federal involvement. And then on the DOMA case, you have the whole tension about why is the federal government getting in the marriage business at all? And so what happens is our rights are getting interpreted and processed through a lens of larger political issues that really have nothing to do with us.
Okay, yeah. We got a couple of calls I want to take, but Kate, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, the court was really struggling with a path forward. They don't want to do a 50-state solution. They wanted to rule narrowly. I think they could rule just on California, and I think what they should do is they should use the California Supreme Court's decision upholding Prop 8 as a guide, because what the court said is even though the California Supreme Court upheld Prop 8, they said that what it amounted to was an exception to the state's equal protection guarantee. That is unprecedented. Equal protection guarantee either means everyone gets protected or no one gets protected. You don't carve out exceptions.
So yeah, let's get to what the California Supreme Court did later, because I'm kind of curious about that. Why would they do that?
Well, I think they were providing an indication of how the Supreme Court, knowing there was going to be a federal challenge, could weigh in and strike down Prop 8. And I think there is a ground for the court to rule on the merits on Prop 8 if they wish to. I'm afraid they're not going to. I think they're just going to rule on standing.
Okay.
But it's fine. Prop 8 would still be gone, and that's still a huge victory.
Thanks. So we're going to go first to we're going to take a call now. Let's go to RJ in San Francisco. Hello. Thanks for calling out in the Bay.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. What will happen? Will LGBT people get to marry if the Supreme Court decides that California, the folks that are defending Prop 8, it's in the court, don't have standing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
Confused on this.
Yeah, RJ, I appreciate the call. If the court rules in June, and we should be clear, we're probably not going to get a ruling until June, probably late June, maybe the Thursday before Pride weekend.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy?
June.
Is that going to be like, they can't rule against us, so there's going to be a revolution on Pride weekend, right?
But boy, it would sure be a fun weekend if it goes our way. And I think if they find that the proponents of Prop 8 don't have standing, that means Judge Walker's ruling
in the trial court.
Is the law of the case. And we believe that applies statewide because the state was a party and his order applies to the entire state. It may take...
Rather than what? Is there a question that it might only apply to some counties?
There is a little bit of a question, and there have been some law professors who have opined that it might only apply in Alameda County and in L.A. where the other plaintiffs live. I actually don't think that's true. I think it will apply statewide. You know, there may be some counties who would revolt, and the AG or the governor will need to direct them. So we might have to work it out a little bit
Modoc
along
County
the margins.
May say hell no.
And I think Jerry Brown is going to make sure that it applies statewide.
I think it will apply statewide, and I think, to RJ's question, couples could begin marrying again in California within, I don't know, what do you think, Fred? I would say within a couple of weeks.
After
sure,
the decision.
I think by middle of July.
Yeah.
So RJ, does that answer your question? Basically, if the Supreme Court tosses out DOMA because it says the House Republicans don't have standing.
No, then, hang on,
Prop 8.
Hang on.
I'm sorry, we're talking about Prop 8. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's confusing.
Then if the proponents of Prop 8 don't have standing, the lower court ruling stands, which is in favor of gay marriage.
And marriages would start up again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, RJ, for calling. And we have a question that came in by email. And this is, if the Supreme Court finds that the Republicans don't have standing to defend DOMA, what happens with DOMA? Does it stay in place?
So that's a much trickier situation because there, if the Supreme Court doesn't rule, the Second Circuit's decision also becomes invalid. And there it goes back to a trial court decision that truly was limited to DOMA, that truly would be limited to those parties in that New York court. And so the concern there is there would not be a national ruling and DOMA would still be in effect. What a lot of people are wondering is whether Obama would then take up what I would call the taunt that the court gave him and say, okay, that trial court ruling is now in a sense a final ruling, and I'm going to order all federal agencies to suspend DOMA, waiting to see if a challenge comes from the other side. But as a matter of law, there would be no national decision on DOMA if they ruled that there's no standing.
I agree with that. I think as we're trying to lay odds on what the court's going to do, Fred and I probably agree that Kennedy will want to reach the merits on DOMA so that this doesn't boomerang back to them soon, which it would. Even if it does apply nationwide because Obama issues an executive order or whatever he does, I think the best bet is that they will find standing for the U.S. government and that they will rule on the merits of DOMA and find that DOMA is violates the Equal Protection Clause.
One thing everybody must remember, there is another clause of DOMA which said no state has to honor another state's marriage. That is not being challenged in this hearing, and that will remain law, which says that it's not a federal violation. And what that is going to lead to is what I'm going to call DOMA 2, which is what happens to that couple that came to California, got married, but lives in Arizona. One of them dies. They live in a non-recognition state. Will the feds say, oh, you're a married couple, we're going to give you benefits? Or will they say, as most people fear, they will say, because your state doesn't recognize you, we're not going to recognize you either. And then that sets up another equal protection question, which is it really fair if you stand in front of the federal agency, Social Security, Immigration, IRS, if you live in a non-recognition state, why is the federal government allowing that unfair limitation to deny you federal benefits?
Let me make sure I got this right. So the full faith and credit clause, which is basically that states recognize marriages performed in other states and other types of family law decisions, right? They won't recognize.
It's actually called comity, not
okay.
Full faith and credit.
Okay, thank you.
And states are not required to recognize the marriages of other states.
They're not.
And they have more flexibility. The full faith and credit has to do with judgments, which is why adoptions get recognized. Marriages don't have an automatic acceptance. Now, historically,
that's including for straight couples.
Historically, there has almost never been a straight marriage that another state didn't recognize. But legally speaking, they have always been free to do that, whether it's a common law marriage, a first cousin marriage, an underage marriage. They just haven't been doing it very often.
Okay,
but the issue in the other part of DOMA is whether the federal government will require one state to recognize another state's marriage. The question I was raising is, if you are stuck in a state that doesn't recognize your out-of-state marriage, will the federal government also refuse to honor it because you live in a non-recognition
state? And that, I think Fred's right. That's going to need to be phase two. But just a little footnote to that, you know, when anti-miscegenation laws were still in effect, often it was the case that even if your home state did not recognize your marriage, the federal government recognized it if
you'd gotten married in a state that did allow
recognize it, the federal government said, we'll recognize it even if you now live in a state that doesn't recognize it. So this is all to say, you know, Fred and I could go on and on like this, that there's going to be some open questions, but you know what? The doors are blowing off.
Right.
I mean,
if
DOMA, if Section 3 of DOMA, this section that forbids federal recognition of marriages, it goes down. That first part of DOMA, Section 2 of DOMA, that permits states to not recognize other marriages, they don't want to recognize same-sex marriages, that is not long for this world, because this house of cards just can't stand.
Okay, before we go to Stefan in Noe Valley, I just want to let you know that you're listening to Out in the Bay on KALW. This Way Out, which is normally heard from 7:30 to 8, we'll be back next week. We're taking a full hour tonight to take your phone calls. The number, if you have questions about the Defense of Marriage Act or the Proposition 8 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the number to call is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can send an email to Eric@outinthebay.com or post a comment on our Facebook page, Out in the Bay. So let's go now to Stefan in Noe Valley. Hi, Stefan. You're on Out in the Bay.
Oh, hi. Thank you. And, you know, I've been wondering this for a long time. Has anyone used Loving versus Virginia as a valid precedent for allowing nationwide gay marriage? And if not, then why not?
It's been used many times. It's been briefed in every. It's been included in every single brief that's been filed in every challenge that's been filed in any court. Stefan, it's important to note that, I mean, Loving versus Virginia, for those who don't know, was the case where the Supreme Court struck down the remaining laws that forbid interracial marriage. And while yes, that's an important precedent because there are many things that are in common in terms of cabining people off and picking and choosing what marriages are going to be recognized or what marriages were valid, it's also important to understand that, you know, discrimination based on race is different in both tenure and character from discrimination based on race. So from a legal perspective, many of the arguments sound very familiar. These aren't legitimate relationships. These will undermine the foundation of society if these marriages are allowed. There are very similar arguments that were used to justify anti-miscegenation laws, and that's why Loving versus Virginia is a case that's been relied on many times, and it actually showed up in these Supreme Court arguments with Ted Olson referring to it.
And how did the justices react to that?
You've got Justice Thomas on the court, African American man married to a white woman, and it's not going to make any difference to him because he doesn't see any similarity between anti-miscegenation laws and laws that exclude same-sex couples from the right to marry. He sees marriages between same-sex individuals as inferior and not appropriate and probably an abomination if he were to ever speak. And he didn't ask any questions in either of the arguments. But many, many people, particularly people of faith in the African-American community, have seen the similarity. And as long as we don't try to test the analogy too far or take it too far or appropriate too much of it, I do think in terms of legal foundation, there's a lot in the history of race discrimination or discrimination based on, you know, where women were property in marriage before. They didn't have their own identity. There's ways in which we've changed marriage many, many times, and almost always the change has been to provide greater freedom, greater choice, greater liberty, and this is the next phase of that history.
Stefan, did that answer your question? You still there?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for calling. Let me give the phone number one more time. It's 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to hear a little bit more of the coverage from NPR. This is Nita Totenberg, who's always covering the Supreme Court, and we start off with where she is talking about, this is, again, the Proposition 8 proponents lawyer Charles Cooper talking about redefining marriage.
It is reasonable to be very concerned that redefining marriage to as a genderless institution could well lead over time to harms to that institution and to the interests that society has always used that institution to address.
Cooper repeatedly insisted that the only interest the state has in granting marriage licenses is to encourage what he called responsible procreation. Justice Kagan followed up with this question.
What harm to the institution of marriage or to opposite sex couples? How does this cause and effect work?
Once again, I would reiterate that we don't believe that's the correct legal question before the court.
The correct legal question, Cooper said, is the right of the state to use a traditional definition of marriage. Justice Scalia chimed in to underline the point.
They're arguing for a nationwide rule, which applies to states other than California, that every state must allow marriage by same-sex couples. And so even those states that believe it is harmful, and I take no position on whether it's harmful or not, but it is certainly true that that there's no scientific answer to that question at this point in time.
Was Justice Scalia. Fred Hertz wanted to jump in and say comment about that.
I just want to put a little historical perspective on this. Two things. One is that the notion that same-sex couples can raise children and be married actually is transforming traditional marriage, and I think it's something that the gay and lesbian community should be proud of. It's following along the lines of feminists who said that men can raise children. It's following along the feminist line that women are not the property of men. And I think that a lot of the discomfort around same-sex couples wanting to be married, especially those who say, well, it's okay if they have civil rights and it's okay if they have civil unions, is exactly that the traditionalists understand that having two men raise a family without a mom, or two women raising children without a dad, is fundamentally transformative of traditional marriage. I think it's something we should be proud of. And I think part of the discomfort, going back to the discomfort of the justices in the Prop 8 case, is they kind of know that that kind of argument doesn't have a place in the Supreme Court. So I think part of what we're seeing going on, and even in fact I think that the defenders of Prop 8, they were so busy trying to repackage their bigotry as saying, oh, we want universality, oh, we want consistency, we love gay people, you know, I don't want my daughter to marry one, but we love it. There is a kind of denial of a larger sociological trend that's going on in families, and I hope that once this political battle and legal battle is won, the lesbians and gay men who are in long-term relationships and raising families can sort of come out and say, actually, we are trying to transform traditional marriage, and we hope that the men and women, the straight men and women in America, will join us.
You know, one thing that was also interesting about the quote that you made is there were that was during a time that was really interesting where Kagan Ginsburg and Sotomayor, the female justices on the court, were very active in questioning Charles Cooper about what is the harm? What is the harm that you can specifically cite by permitting same-sex couples to marry? And the only thing Cooper could come up with is, we don't know yet because we haven't had enough time, but there may be harms. No one can say for sure what they might be.
But God forbid you should risk it.
But yeah, but we shouldn't take the risk. And it was so interesting that he was not able to articulate. It was only prospective harms.
I think it's he knew that what he and his followers believe are the harms just wouldn't be
appropriate.
Wouldn't hold water.
But, you know, and the other admission, he made a couple of damning admissions. The first was, you know, the harms are all perspective. I can't name any harms right now. Is at one point Justice Sotomayor asked him, outside of the context of marriage, would it be permissible for a state to burden or in any other way disadvantage individuals based on sexual orientation? And Cooper's answer, not in any way I can think of.
I felt we could pack up and go home right
and
there.
And at that point, you're like, okay, do you know what you just admitted? What he essentially admitted is there is no justification for discriminating against an individual based on sexual orientation in any realm other than marriage. And in marriage, it's only because there may be these harms, which I can't talk about right now because I don't know what they would be, but I see them out there somewhere, maybe two generations from now. And you know what? We don't deny people constitutional rights based on, you know, theoretical fears.
And one of the justices at one point said, and I'm not sure which case it was in, I listened to both today and was kind of going back and forth, but one of them said, so we're just talking about a label then, is that right?
Yeah, well, that was Kennedy and Roberts both, because but the point Roberts was trying to make is, well, if they've got everything else, why does it have to be marriage? And Roberts made an analogy that was actually painful for many of us in the room to listen to. You know, if someone tells their child, you have to be friends with that person and call that person your friend, even if the child doesn't like that person, they may call them a friend, but that doesn't make them a friend. Right. And so it was a really creepy analogy to suggest to, you know, you can call this thing that same-sex couples have a marriage, but it's really not a marriage. And not only that, but it's disfavored and it's unpleasant. And, you know, that, in addition to several other comments, actually put to rest a hope that had been sort of nascent in my heart that maybe Roberts was going to be better on our issues than one might think, but he could not have been any worse.
Okay. Well, we need to take a couple calls now. Let's go to, is it Millie in Berkeley?
Yes, hello.
Hi, thanks for calling.
There's so much nonsense spoken on this subject. I'm just dazzled with what you people are reporting. But I wanted to say, if people want to go back to the Bible and look up the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, they will see that while what's-her-name was turned to a pillar of salt for looking back, what happened when her husband and two daughters went on was incest. Well, now that's not necessarily a good sign. The alternative to the behavior of sodomy was incest.
Well, one of the things that we talked about before was standing in civil rights. The other aspect of this whole battle is, what is the place of Christian religion or Jewish religion in our civil society? And my response to all questions about religion in the Bible is, we're talking about civil marriage, not religious marriage.
Good.
And they... inability of most people in this country to keep these in mind. One thing I want to mention about this, because it has to do with domestic partnership versus marriage. One of the complaints about domestic partnership, which I didn't quite understand at first but now do, is that the lack of solemnization and the lack of public ritual has not only denigrated the event, it actually has harmed couples. They don't know whether they've been married or whether they just signed a form. They don't know whether the state form is the same as the city form. People don't value it. And so the sanctification and solemnization in marriage is actually one of the reasons it differs from domestic partnership. At the same time, one of the problems we have in our
society... I think that's very important.
It
don't
is.
You?
Yes, of course. But one of the ironies is that, unlike almost every other civil society, the United States allows priests and rabbis to solemnize civil marriages. Most of Europe doesn't allow that. And so one of the reasons why people keep bringing up the religious argument is that because rabbis and priests and ministers can solemnize civil marriages, a lot of people getting married forget that it's a civil marriage. So I think that one of the things that all of us need to be speaking out for is to speak with respect for people's religion, but explain that this is about civil marriage, not religious marriage, and no one is requiring any religious authority to solemnize a civil marriage.
I think that's very important. Thank you very much.
Millie, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go on now to Carolyn in Berkeley. Carolyn, you there? Line two?
Yes, I am. Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
You have already started to address my question. But I was curious why we would never make the argument that, in fact, our religious rights were being violated by people who were using their religion to prevent same-sex couples from getting married.
I use it a lot. I'm Jewish, and I say it over and over again. My mother does not approve of an interfaith marriage, but it would never occur to her to ask the legislature to impose her religious beliefs on a Christian who wanted to marry a Muslim or a Jew. So I agree that part of religious freedom is the freedom for me to be religious, free of another person's religious dogma.
Is it not relevant, really, in the legal arguments? I've never heard it alluded to.
Kate?
Well, it's not that it's not relevant, Carolyn. I think that what most of the arguments focus on that these are two separate spheres, and to Fred's earlier point, that what we're talking about is civil marriage and the right under the civil law and under the protections of equal protection to have all couples treated equally under the law, regardless of their faith or lack of faith, or regardless of other individuals' faith who may disagree with it. It doesn't really find its way into the courtroom and into the arguments, because it's one of those things that we don't have a way to have a discourse that doesn't make it feel like someone's losing.
Well, the other piece is there is no organized religion that is stepping forth and saying allowing homosexuals to marry is a crucial tenet of our faith. So this is unlike, for example, the discussions about wearing a skull cap on a Saturday or being forced to work on a Sunday is a violation of religious rights. The freedom from other people's religion is, I think, most effectively argued by devout members of one religion who are being prevented from exercising their religion. And that's not happening here.
Right.
Because the right for same-sex couples to marry is not a religious tenet.
And, you know, the other thing, the way we're seeing it come up, though, and this is really important for people to keep an eye on, because this is going to be the next wave of the cases we're going to see, is it's not so much that you can make the argument that these laws that prohibit same-sex couples from marrying are religiously based or some form of religious persecution. There's just not enough evidence to support that. There's all sorts of different reasons why people have prejudicial attitudes against LGBT people. Maybe religious faith is one of them, but you can't really cabin it. The one thing that we have to be concerned about, though, is that more and more the writing is on the wall. If Rush Limbaugh knows this is inevitable, so do religious leaders. And now what they're trying to do is get laws passed that create religious exemptions. So even when we make gains, even when we win the right to marry, it's not just that priests don't have to marry gay people. That's never going to be the case. But it's that we won't be able to have businesses make cakes for our weddings or be the photographer at our weddings if they choose not to because of their religious beliefs are offended by a same-sex marriage. And these are people who are in the open market, who are part of public accommodations law, and they're subject to non-discrimination laws. But more and more we are seeing incursions into non-discrimination laws, carving out these religious exemptions, because what essentially people who, based on their religious beliefs, don't like gay people want is, as we gain rights, they don't want to change anything about their day-to-day life's activities or the way they conduct their business.
Carolyn, thanks for the call. I want to go on to Ron in San Francisco. Ron, thanks for calling out in the Bay.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. I was listening to or watching Piers Morgan earlier. He was interviewing Billy Graham's son regarding gay marriage. And I will preface this by saying that I've been in recovery from the Catholic Church for 53 years. Okay, and so I'm horrified at the kinds of things that they continue to bring up, the fundamentalists.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ron. Cardinal, what's his name? The new cardinal for San Francisco was actually in San Francisco,
yes,
kind of advocating for DOMA and Prop 8,
right?
Yep. Yes, he's the lion heart. He's the cardinal, who is, well, he's an archbishop.
He's, Thank you, Archbishop.
And they call him Lionheart. His name,
Cardinal Leon. Yes.
Cardinal Leon. Yes. In any event, Billy Graham's son was talking about this being God's law and that we can't change God's law. It's one man and one woman. One thing that no one seems to ever bring up is that Christ said in the New Testament, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And yet, that's the one thing that the fundamentalists repeatedly overturn for themselves in their own best interests. They marry, divorce, remarry, and so forth. And there was a really good short comment in the Chronicle the other day, a letter to the editor, about the numbers of heterosexual marriages that end in divorce, and there is no father in the family. And is it better for those children in that situation, or is it better for them to be in the family where there are two same-gender parents?
Well, Ron, I would respond in the following way. First of all, I think we have to distinguish between genuinely spiritual people who have a spirituality that is gendered based, who really believe there are men's roles and women's roles, and that this is part of their theology. I want to distinguish between those people and those who I would consider political opportunists who use religious language to further their political goals. But among those who are genuinely religious and genuinely upset about this, keep in mind, and I've heard from a lot of fabulous black civil rights leaders who say, when every day you are told that if you are homosexual or you accept a homosexual, you are going to burn in hell for all eternity. If you're told those sorts of things, you can't expect people to change in a night or two or a day or two. And what I would say is that there are some fabulous organizations in the gay and lesbian community that are working in communities of faith where gay Mormons are talking to Mormons, gay Catholics are talking to Catholics, Orthodox Jews are talking to Jews, and they are working with people. It can take years for people to unlearn these kinds of rules they were taught. And I think one of the most wonderful and dynamic components of our LGBT community are the religious activists who are taking these people on from a shared position of faith and saying we disagree. And I want to be respectful for the people who genuinely have these beliefs as opposed to just those who are politically opportunists.
Ron, I want to thank you for that call. And it brings me to one quick question that's really kind of irrelevant but tangentially related. Can we go naked in Dolores Park this Sunday? Is that considered a street, you know, with the new anti-nudity laws in San Francisco? Is that considered?
You mean particularly for Easter?
Well, yeah, because it's like a street fair? You know, like Folsom Street Fair, it's okay to be naked,
and
right?
Isn't there a celebration exception? I think.
Yeah, I just don't know.
I thought you were going to somehow say this is about Jesus on the cross. I didn't quite get what you were heading to.
Well, you know, just because Ron said he was a recovering Catholic, and the Catholic Church opposed that so strongly several years ago, and they lost, and so it continues. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, Dolores Park Easter. Of course, I think it's going to
rain. Well, maybe if they're busy working on the nudists, they won't be so upset about homosexuals.
Maybe that's it. Okay, so back to a serious moment. We've only got a few minutes left, but. I want to get in just very briefly to your personal lives. I know, Kate, you're married. You got married during the window. Is that right?
We did.
In 2008.
We did. Sandy and I got married. Then this year will be our 20th year together.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
And Fred, you've been with your partner for quite a long time, but you have chosen not to be married. In fact, you're not even registered domestic partners, and you help people with their relationship. What was the word you used? Dissolutions and getting together contracts.
Well, one of the things I want to be open about is that I believe that everyone should have the right to marry. I think statistics have shown that getting married doesn't guarantee a happy or a long relationship. And I want people to get married because it's meaningful to them, because it has a legal structure that they like. I happen to be, you know, my partner and I celebrated our 30th anniversary, and I'm still of that generation that feels like I don't want the government regulating my personal life. I don't want to go through a legal marriage, and I certainly don't want to go through a legal divorce. I also happen to be able to meet all of our legal needs. I can afford legal services. I don't have children. I can afford to have an estate plan. Neither of us are dependent on each other. So I am one of those people who doesn't need marriage in the kind of day-to-day sense that so many low-income, minority parents need. So it doesn't hit me in the way that it hits others. I have the luxury of living outside of these legal rules. Mm-hmm. So for us, it has worked better. And I hope that in the fight for the right to marry, couples will each think long and hard about whether this is right for them. The last thing I want to see, and I see a lot of them now coming my way, are couples that got married simply because they had a legal right without understanding that it also was a personal financial commitment, a personal ethical and I would say moral commitment, for better or worse. And I want couples to feel that they can choose to get married and that the right to marry is not the duty to marry.
Now, you also said recently that you would, depending on how the DOMA case is ruled on, you might register as domestic partner. So what's the possible change there? And why would that depend on how that case turns out?
Well, as I said, for me, there are certain areas where I could be financially and legally harmed by not being married or registered.
Okay.
And if DOMA is lifted, I will do a different analysis, again, based on the practical needs of my family and my partner.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Fred. You know, what, to the extent there's any gay agenda, you know, it's an agenda of fundamental justice and equality where we have the same opportunities, the same freedoms, and the same ability to deliberate about what's right for our relationships, free from unwarranted government intrusion or the government of government exclusion. So this is true for, you know, don't ask, don't tell, whatever you feel about the military. I feel like there should not be a blanket exclusion on LGBT, and we'll hopefully get to T soon, serving in the military. And it's the same way with marriage. Winning a sense of equality where we grow up and kids grow up in a country where they see themselves as queer kids being just equally a part of the landscape. They see themselves as elected officials. They see somebody on the Supreme Court, hopefully someday. They see in every fabric of life, you see openly LGBT people. It's just, you want that sort of normalizing so then people can make choices that are best for them considering all the circumstances.
Well, that wraps it up. Kate Kendall of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, thank you so much for coming in. Fred Hertz, attorney who specializes in same-sex relationship law and operates samesexlaw.com, thank you so much for being here. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Any parting thoughts? You know, I mean, looks like we may have a celebration in June. We might have a celebration at least on one, and you think maybe on both?
I think we'll probably have a celebration on both. And my only parting thought would be, and, you know, having been in the Supreme Court this week, you know, we just have to take a breath and realize this moment that we're in. I mean, many people, we stand on a lot of shoulders of people who did not live to see this moment, and yet worked very hard for LGBT liberation. And this is just an extraordinary moment that we are in, and I feel so grateful to be alive, and I think we all should just have a moment of gratitude that we're here.
And I think it's also equally important that when there is the right to marry, people think carefully about who they're going to marry and when.
Okay, and whether to do it or not. Okay, very good. If you want more information about Kate and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, it's nclr.org. More information about Fred at samesexlaw.com. We bring you conversations you aren't likely to hear elsewhere because we're able to have on guests that most mainstream programs can't or just don't. So we hope that's of value to you and that you'll consider keeping Out in the Bay going strong for another 8 years. Please consider a tax-deductible contribution at our website, outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information information online at sfbar.org/LRIS. That's the Legal Lawyer Referral and Information Service, sfbar.org/LRIS, or call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. We'd love to hear from you, so write to us, marilyn@outinthebay.com and eric@outinthebay.com. Thanks so much for listening.